Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Jane, and I'm an alcoholic. And thanks to this wonderful program of AA, to wonderful sponsorship, the grace of God, my wonderful family, and my beautiful friends, I have been sober since September 24th, 1996. Woo! And I'll tell you, I have had such a wonderful time at this convention. It has been awesome. How about the speakers? Whoa! And just to get all the niceties out of the way, there's so many people I want to thank, but especially Sonia and Michael. You guys really went out of your way to show me great hospitality. I want to thank Virginia for taking care of everything. And I know she's probably not here, but I actually got invited by a wonderful woman named Tracy F. 2 years ago. And we corresponded, you know, back and forth for the last 2 years. So anyway, she's with us here today in spirit for sure. I think she's in Hawaii or something, having a wonderful new life. She is here? Okay, cool. And also the grace for the beautiful basket in the room and, you know, just everything. I realize all the hard work that goes into these conventions, and it's just mind-blowing. The fact that I get invited to speak at these conventions still blows my mind because, you know, I think every single one of us in this room could actually be up here, you know, behind this microphone telling their story. You know, my pain is no more, no less than whatever pain you've all experienced to earn your seat in this room this morning. And I can't help but think about the miracles that are all present today. We're all miracles. We all today, however, are enjoying this precious life-giving gift that we call sobriety, and what a wonderful way to live. I also love the name of the convention, too, Let Peace Begin With Me, and I think peace begins with a smile, and I've just felt so peaceful all weekend, receiving all the wonderful smiles. Everyone here is just so much fun. I know, yeah, we were boogieing out on the dance floor last night to the Burning Desires too, and yeah, it was just really a great convention, and I'm honored to be, you know, the last speaker. So I also like to start out with a prayer because I'm really nervous. I know my sponsor tells me, don't worry about if you're nervous. It actually means that you're humble enough to let God in, and boy, I'm feeling really humble right now. But anyway, I really would like for anyone who would wish to join me to read I'm going to say the third step prayer, and I would really appreciate if you would recite it with me. God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to be with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that I have victory over them. May they bear witness to those I help of Thy power, Thy will, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Amen. Take my will and my life. Guide me in my recovery. Show me how to live. And please put the words into my mouth that somebody in this audience needs to hear today. Okay, I also am really honored because I have an entourage with me this weekend. Usually I go on these myself, but I want to recognize one person in my family that I'm really, really, really proud of, and it's my 17-year-old nephew who just celebrated 2.5 years of sobriety. So Jack, stand up. So anyway, Jack lives in Houston, and I'll tell you something. The first time, this is the third time that I've been to Texas. The first time was when I was young and crazy. I think I was about 25, and I went to Padre Island for spring break at 25. And I remember, you know, I remember I went with this crazy Texan girl named Georgette. I remember we had to go to Mexico, you know, and I had to drink tequila. So the last thing I remember is being in this dark, dingy room, and I did probably 3-4 shots of tequila. The mariachi band was playing in the background, and I ate the worm. And I must have had a really good time because I woke up the next morning, didn't have the clothes on that I had on the night before. I had a bikini on, and I was not in bikini shape back then. And I woke up on a beach not knowing if I was in Mexico or back in Padre Island, Texas. So, yeah, that was a really good time. That was time number one. The second time I remember I saw ZZ Top. And I remember looking at my girlfriend, Chris, and I was going, man, I thought there were only 3 dudes in this band. I'm seeing like 6, 7, 8 up there. She's like, Jane, go like this. And then the third time I came was a couple of years ago, and I spoke at Club 12. Sober Jane finally arrived in Texas. And let me tell you something, Club 12 rocks. That was one of my best speaking experiences that I ever had. I mean, it was really a wonderful, you know, experience. And my brother, my older brother Fred, who's here today too, he had just started experiencing the problems that his family, his wife, Barbara, who's also here, were experiencing with Jack, didn't know anything about recovery. And you guys just, you know, I mentioned that at Club 12, and you guys just swarmed around him, loved him, hugged him, gave him reassurance, told him where the meetings were in Houston. And, you know, today we have, they're living a wonderful life as a happy family again. So thanks, Club 12. And I get invited to a lot of these things by, you know, two of my favorite people, Jill and Jerry, who run the tape, Master Tapes. And let me tell you something. What they do is truly a vocation. You know, I remember the first time I told my story was at this little meeting place, and somehow it's made it all over the country. You know, and that's the miracle of the program, actually. The true miracle of the program is that every day somewhere in this world, one alcoholic shares their story with another alcoholic. And actually, that's my opinion. That's the biggest miracle of the program. God speaks differently to all of us, but he expects us to share our stories. And I know by a lot of people use the speaker tapes, you know, to take trips. They listen to a meeting. A lot of people who are infirmed can have meetings by these tapes, and I know for myself, somebody who doesn't drive, I also, you know, have in the past gotten great benefits from people who have, you know, handed me these tapes. So you guys check out Master Tapes and give them as gifts. What better gift can you give somebody than a story that's filled with hope and love and instruction. So anyway, and also when I'm in this room, I can't help but to think about God's grace, you know, and how amazing it is, and how, you know, it's really cool because it's nothing that we've done that gets us grace. It's just there. It's here, and I feel it. I truly feel it in this room today, and what a sweet assurance it is knowing that grace is always with us. Sometimes our dark past can be our greatest gift, and I'm gonna, you know, share with you the gift of my dark past in my story today. I've been commissioned by Alcoholics Anonymous as a servant of Alcoholics Anonymous to get up here today to talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. So I guess I might as well begin at the beginning. I was born on November 20th, 1962. In a town named Caldwell, New Jersey, which is, you know, now very well known because it's the home of Tony Soprano. Anyway, it's a really nice hometown, a suburb of New York. And I had the most wonderful childhood. I mean, really, it was awesome. Come from a really big Irish Catholic family, and I think just to be born Irish Catholic genetically predisposes you to the disease of alcoholism. But, you know, seriously, neither my mom nor dad drink, though. I mean, they will at weddings. My dad will at weddings, but my mom, never drank. But when you look in the family tree, it's all over with aunts, uncles, cousins. It's pretty fascinating. But I think I'm one of five children, and I think before any of us were out of diapers, we were saying the Hail Mary, the Our Father, the Act of Contrition, and the Apostles' Creed. So we had like a really religious upbringing, went to Catholic schools our whole life, I actually went to a Catholic elementary school, an all-girls Catholic high school, and a Catholic college. So, we were raised with close relations to all the priests and nuns that that we encountered were, big influences in our lives too. I'm one of those people that had a really positive experience with nuns and priests. Some of them were, some of my best mentors, and actually to this day, some of my best friends are religious, and priests and nuns religious is what I meant. But anyway, I guess to explain the way that I was growing up, I was always very gregarious and funny, and we did a lot of fun things as a family, took great family trips. My dad was a world-class athlete and a world-class coach as well. So he was pretty disciplined, and he demanded respect. It was almost like he was a military dad in so many ways. But he definitely was strict, and we had to abide by his rules. But he also was a very loving father. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. Her whole life was dedicated to taking care of her husband and raising her kids. So we were really lucky. And my dad worked at a college, so we had summers off, so we took some great summer trips. And, again, just to explain the way that I was raised, it was just one of happiness and laughter and love. It was probably when I went to high school that I started to get my little rebellious spirit going on, started to, have issues with my mom, started to realize I was way smarter than my mother was, but it was still kind of done in like a really innocent way. It didn't involve alcohol or drugs or anything. It was just my little inner rebellion, and it started probably when I was like 13. And the first time that I had my first drink, I was actually 14. And I went, my older cousin who was 18 took me to the movies. And the movie that I went to see was the original Star Wars. And so I remember she got the big sodas and she was like dumping rum into the sodas. And, and I remember just being blown away by, the cinematography that was in that film. It was the coolest thing I had ever seen. I mean, the rockets flying all over the place, Battlestar Galactica or whatever it was called, the visual effects. And what it really did symbolically was it brought me into a whole nother world. It put me on a whole other plane, and I just loved that feeling. It was really like, wow, this is cool. And I also remember just feeling that, all my insecurities just kind of melted away. I was loud. I was obnoxious. I was funny. I was larger than life, just like what I was seeing on the screen. So I always, marvel at the coincidence that was like the first time that I ever got drunk. But of course, I got really sick afterwards and was sworn off alcohol for, a couple more years. I didn't drink again until I actually went to college. So when I did go to college, it was sort of like the girl living in the glass house moving to New York City. And I went to Manhattan College, and when I when I started college, I had every intention of going into, like, you know, the medical field. And freshman semester, from September until December, I put on 25 pounds, and I'm here to tell you that it definitely was not the food. It was the beer. I mean, I partied and partied and partied. And it was really cool because most of the kids that went to college with me were like of Irish Catholic or Irish Italian descent, and they were all doing the same things that I was doing, so I didn't see anything wrong with it. I didn't see anything wrong with, like, going out and, you know, drinking seven nights a week and, you know, blowing off studying until midterms and then finals. And the other really dangerous thing was we were the very last stop on the subway, on the one train, 242nd Street and Broadway, so we had access into Manhattan whenever. So I am here to tell you that I tore up New York City back in my college years. And just to give you guys an idea, too, it was the 80s. It was 81, 82, 83, 84. Okay, so I'm talking about I was hanging at Studio 54. I was hanging at the Peppermint Lounge. I was hanging at the Limelight. I was, you know, I saw the Talking Heads at CBGB's, the Ramones at CBGB's. I mean, it was that really cool period of time, but it was crazy. It was also a really crazy time. I remember, you know, oh, and this is a part of my story that I have to include, because if I didn't, I would be lying by omission. But the way that I like to explain it is, you know, alcohol was definitely my drug of choice, but I also liked to smoke and snort a lot of outside issues, and especially in the 80s in New York, you know what I'm talking about. And you know, a lot of times I've you know, gotten some feedback like, you know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, all we need to do is talk about alcoholness. And so, yeah, I totally agree with singleness of purpose. Totally agree with singleness of purpose. But the way that I justify bringing that in is, you know what, we all do crazy things when we start drinking. You know, some of us write bad checks. Some of us, like, wake up naked on somebody's front lawn the next morning or on a beach in Padre Island. Some of us, you know, wake up not remembering where you parked your car. Some of us, you know, get involved in, you know, domestic violence things. And some of us just, you know, just do crazy things. You know what I'm talking about. And one of the crazy things that I did was smoke and snort a lot of outside issues. And that when I smoked them, it totally enhanced my drinking. And when I snorted them, it totally allowed me to drink for much longer periods of time and got me home safely on more than one occasion. So, so anyway, that's the way that I like to justify it. But again, I would be lying if I didn't say that that was a big part of my story. So anyway, yeah, college, my junior year of college, I was getting tired by my third year of college. So my junior year of college, I decided to study overseas in France. And I also wanted to get away from all the partying that was going on in New York. So I went over to France, and I studied over there for a year, and, you know, things didn't get any better. It actually escalated. We all know the story. It's a, you know, it's a progressive disease. And I remember I was living with a French woman and her 11-year-old son, and he had a French college student that was his tutor, and her name was Miriam, and she was 19, I was 21. And we tore up the city that we lived in Nantes. I mean, you know, again, we went out every single night. It's a good thing that was a pass-fail system, because I passed by the skin of my teeth. But anyway, we still had a great time, and it was a wonderful opportunity to, you know, just get overseas and see the way that other people live. And I also had the opportunity to backpack through Europe when I was finished. And amazingly enough, everywhere I went, I met party people. I mean, it's almost like we're magnets when we're out there. It's like I met all these crazy party people. And it was just, you know, it was one of the best experiences of my life. But, man, it was all about partying. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to London in a couple of weeks. But I was already in London during that period of time. I don't remember anything. I don't remember anything. I don't remember seeing London Bridge. I don't remember seeing, you know, the Crown Jewels or whatever. I don't remember seeing anything. I just remember going from pub to pub to pub and having a lot of fun. So anyway, that's part of that, by the way, is one of the best gifts, in my opinion, of sobriety that we get to redo some of the things that we didn't do right the first time. So anyway, after my junior year of college, I moved back to New York senior year, and you know, the drinking escalated. You know, we all know the story. It just got worse and worse and worse. But I somehow landed a job teaching high school. So I taught high school English and English world literature and French. And I don't know how I did it. My God, I look back at those days. I lived in a city called Hoboken, New Jersey at that time, and it was where all the young people lived that couldn't afford to live in New York City, so they lived on the Jersey side. And it's, I think, per capita, I think it has more bars than any other city in the United States. So anyway, but I loved living in Hoboken. And once again, you know, things just kept getting progressively worse. But I thought I was having a great time. And for the most part, I was having a great time. But this is when my family started thinking, I think Jane might have a problem. This is when people started, you know, not inviting me to parties. I sometimes would just look at my mother's face when we would get invited to weddings and stuff, and it would be like, you're going to be good today, right, Janie? And, you know, I was definitely making my family start to worry. And you know, invariably, I did make a total and utter ass of myself at the family functions. But anyway, I still felt like, how can I say it? I always suffered from self-esteem. And I think that's worth mentioning too at this point, because I'm sure a lot of you can relate. I think my real problem was self-esteem. And I don't know why, because my parents grown up always told me how beautiful I was and how smart I was. And really, I had everything going on in my life. But it's that, again, that spiritual malady that starts in us early, that hole that people talk about so much. Yeah, I think mine, well, I know it was really, you know, issues with self-esteem. So alcohol did something magical with that. It got rid of all my self-esteem issues. When I walked into a room, I didn't want to just be anybody. I wanted to be that larger-than-life person, that person that everybody turned around and looked at and was like, wow, Jane's here, you know, the person that was really the rebel-rouser, the one that made the party fun. And that's definitely what alcohol and drugs did for me. I'm going to try and fast forward a little bit. I hope that you have a good idea of what my life was like. But again, it was all about, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll in the 80s. I'm going to, you know, fast forward through the sex stuff because my big brother and my nephew are here. But I wasn't, you know. Ladies, if you're in this room and you're an alcoholic, you do know what I'm talking about. And then again, you know, the lifestyle just lends itself to, you know, like I said, when I was teaching high school, I don't know how I did it. It was definitely, you know, I feel it like bursting into song. It was life in the fast lane, everything all the time. I mean, really. I don't know how I did what I did. And the energy level came from, you know, from obviously the alcohol and the drugs. But anyway, moving forward too, I want to just let you know that I never got into any trouble. I always got out of any bad situation that I was in. I was like this protected little princess that like rose a little bit above all the harsh realities of life. I never got in trouble. Okay, so after teaching high school for 3 years, I got bored with that, and started to get into some trouble too. I got asked to go teach over in Japan, And I thought, you know, this would be a great change. I can get out of New York, get away from the drugs. I hear, like, they don't have any drugs over in Japan, so I'll go over and drink over there, and I'm going to totally change my lifestyle. And so I moved to Japan, and sure enough, I met the most awesome, crazy people, crazy English people, Irish people, Canadian people. You know, I mean, it was just a bunch of just party people that were planted over in this part of Japan that I lived in. As a matter of fact, one of my friends is here today. Her name's Tracy. She was one of my party girlfriends in Japan that I haven't seen in 20 years. So she's seen Sober Jane for the first time. I think she's a little still in shock and disbelief. But anyway, it was just so much fun. And so I worked for Time Life Educational Services, and I actually taught Japanese businessmen how to speak English, or, you know, really honed their English before they were being sent overseas. So they were freaking out because the nature of my class was like a month long in a training center, and they had to, like, study from breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And it was all the, you know, like I said, the top businessmen that were about to be sent overseas. And they had a very difficult lifestyle. Their lifestyle is really kind of sad. I mean, it's very regimented, very work-oriented. So they were totally psyched when they saw this 25-year-old crazy girl bebop into the room saying she was going to be their teacher for the next month. And they took me out drinking every night. Every night. For them, it was like a vacation. And, you know, and, oh, I'll tell you, the cultural exchanges that went down, the Japanese that I spoke, I mean, you know, we really had a good time. And it's funny because I'm also, when I'm in London, I'm going to be visiting one of my other friends from my Japanese period, and she actually ripped a page out of her journal and sent it to me recently, and it said, "My friend Jane has decided to cut down on her drinking. That means that she didn't have a drink for lunch on Wednesday." So I was like, oh, God, was I that bad? But anyway, I guess I was. But anyway, and we've just had some good times talking about, you know, how crazy things were over there. But we all agreed, too, like, hey, it was fun. It was fun. Sometimes I get people in AA saying, no, you just thought it was fun. No, it was fun. We had a great time. We really did. So, but anyway, I did that for 3 years, and then I, you know, of course, that got out of control, and I was like, I got to go home. I have to, you know, okay, I'm pushing 30. I got to start looking for a husband if I want to get married and have kids and blah, 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 blah. I wasn't really attracted to the Japanese men, so I was like, you know what, I think it's time for me to go home. So I came back, and, you know, we all know the story. I'm just going to rush through this. It was much of the same. It was the same thing over and over again everywhere I went. I looked for all these geographical changes, and, you know, they were never there. Why? Obviously, the problem was me. So anyway, I went back, and I got a job in New York, and, you know, things just got worse, and that's when I got my first DUI. And a friend of mine lived down in the Florida Keys, and I thought, and he said, you know, Jane, I have a restaurant down here. If you lose your license, you know, why don't you move down to the Florida Keys? And I was like, that sounds like a good idea. I'm going to go down to the Florida Keys and stop drinking, learn how to stop drinking and stay clean and sober. So I did, and that didn't work either. As a matter of fact, I got another DUI when I was down in the Keys. And that's why I love my older brother, Fred. Like, he's like the Stillwater runs deep guy in my family. And whenever I had, like, you know, something crazy would happen, like, like what happened down in the Keys when I got that second DUI, because I was borrowing my boss's car when I got it, and that car didn't have insurance on it at the time, and I totaled the car. And, you know, I'd just be like, Fred, oh, my God, you're not going to believe what I did. And he was always just this calm, okay, well, it's done. Now what are you going to do next? You know, he always was very wise like that. He never, you know, I would be the hysterical one. He was always like my rock and the first one that I would call. But I did get into a lot of trouble down there. And again, I was just miserable, and it wasn't just alcohol either. It was, you know, by that time I was really on my road to self-destruction. My mother had, you know, said that she didn't want me to be her daughter anymore. She was sick and tired of me. She was, you know, that was that. She was disgusted with me, ashamed of me. And, you know, for some reason I just went on this like road of self-destruction. It was a very dark period in my time down in the Florida Keys. And for some reason, I was probably down to about 110 pounds. If I, like, even hit this, I would turn black and blue. I was so malnourished. I just had, like, the spiritual awakening, and I was like, you know, I got to call someone for help. So I called a cousin of mine up in Fort Lauderdale, and thank God she let me move back up there with her to get it together. And I really did start trying to get it together. Still wasn't, like, admitting that I was an alcoholic and needed meetings or anything like that. You know, I went through some rough days, but I pretty much always got sober on my own. And it would just be for very short periods. And then I never committed suicide, but again, I just didn't want to live. So, I never committed suicide, but never even thought of committing suicide, but I really just did not want to live. So, okay, so I moved back up to Fort Lauderdale. I meet this great guy. He was actually living over in Europe at the time. He was living in Austria, and he was really cool. He was very adventurous like I was, and we decided to take a trip down to the Florida Keys for a little vacation. And as soon as we hit the, you know, first tiki bar, boom, we went in and we went and had a couple drinks. And the trip down involves a lot of tiki bars, by the way. So by the time we got to where we were going, we were both pretty loaded. And, I don't know how many drinks we had, but we had a lot. And this is the part of the story that I hate, and I always get really emotional, so bear with me. But so somebody told us that there was a really great scenic overview point where we could go park. It was actually the old 7 Mile Bridge. And they had just blown that bridge up for that movie True Lies with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So anyway, we were, you know, proceeding down the bridge. There was a big sign that said authorized vehicles only. And we were like, oh, well, vehicles can go down it. Let's, you know, take a little drive and see what that's all about. We got the beer in the back, some weed in the front. You know, this will be good. And so we were just driving down that street, you know, and it was like just an old bridge road, and we didn't know where it was going to. And as soon as we went around a curve, there was this big cement barrier that I went barreling right into at a pretty high speed. And I remember just thinking, like, oh, my God, where did that come from? Who put that thing there? And I remember looking over at Max, and he just looked like he hit his head, and he was passed out. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, this is like this flash lightning of pain. And I put my hand down to my ankles, and when I lifted my hand up, it was just covered in blood, and I could feel the bones in my ankle. And the pain was just so tremendous. I realized I couldn't move my left side. I was trying to get out of the door, and at that time I had no idea that I broke my neck. But if I had moved in any sudden position, I would have been killed instantly because the fracture was C1, C2, and if it had hit my spinal cord, you know, that would have been the end of me. So, but anyway, I was thinking, trying to, you know, scam. How am I going to get out of here? How are we going to break out? Maybe we could. You know, I could grab him and we could, you know, crawl out the door, but there was no way. There was no way. And it didn't take me long to realize that that Max wasn't breathing. and that he was dead. And it took a long time. It took a really long time for the police officers to find me. To find him. But I just couldn't believe that he was dead. And if he wasn't dead, how come I wasn't dead? And I wanted to be dead. But then I started thinking about my family, you know. I can't do this to my mom and dad. I can't do this to my brothers. I can't do this to my sister. And what about his family, you know? How is anybody going to forgive me? How is anybody going to understand how this happened? And I'll never forget when I saw those blue lights. It was the angel. He was such an angel, that police officer, you know. I mean, I thought for sure that everyone was just going to look at me like I was this, you know, disgusting, you know, killer drunk driver, and, you know, what, let her lay there and suffer. Like, I couldn't believe how nice everyone was being to me. And I was in such excruciating pain, but I hate to even talk about the excruciating pain when I think about the emotional pain of knowing that a life was no longer here because of my irresponsibility of getting behind the wheel of a car and driving. And it's not like I hadn't made that mistake before. So anyway, I got heliported down to the University of Miami Hospital, and I know my dad came down, you know, with his shirt on his back, and one of my brothers, and because they told my parents that they didn't think I was going to make it through the night. But anyway, when I fast forward through this part too, but to make a long story short, you know, I ended up staying in the hospital for 6 months, and then I had to go to a rehab hospital for 6 months, and then I got sentenced to prison for 5 years. 5 years prison, 10 years probation. And, oh my gosh. But in the rehab hospital is when I went through my transformations. That's when I went through my psychic change. That's when, you know, I realized I can't do this anymore. That was when I was first introduced to the Big Book. I read bits and pieces of it, but I remember when my dad came, I remember I looked up at him, I was like, "Dad, the accident didn't happen because I was drinking. You know, it was because that stupid wall got put up," you know. I mean, the denial was just so, it was still so there. So anyway, I got transferred to a rehab center, and that's where I went to my first AA meeting. And it was pretty much my family saying, you know, "You better go, or, you know, you can kiss your family goodbye because we can't do this anymore." So that's exactly how I got to AA, you know, and it was pretty pathetic, you know, when I was in a wheelchair and I had the halo traction on, and they had to wheel me into the meetings, and, you know, and I was still like, you know, look at what had to happen to me to get my ass to get to a meeting, you know. But anyway, the meeting that really did save my life, though, the meetings that did save my life were in St. Pete Beach, Florida. That was when I was was released of my own recognizance, and I had to go to an AA meeting every day. And that group welcomed me with open arms like a mother would a child. I mean, they took such good care of me. And it was in those meetings that I heard things like,
there, but for the grace of God, go I. Do you know how many times I drove drunk and how many times that could have happened to me? You know, and for some reason that made me feel better, you know, because I just felt like, you know, this terrible piece of crap that, you know, that killed somebody. So I got a sponsor right off the bat, and we're still friends today, and she's still, you know, my sponsor. You know, I have another sponsor who's an old-timer in Tallahassee, but she's still a really good friend of mine, and she was so cool. She was my lifeline. And, you know, she didn't care that I was in no shape to start the steps or to, you know, to do anything but read the book. And even that, I wasn't really, again, I was so scared because I knew I was going to prison. I just didn't know for how long. But believe me, until the pain gets strong enough, you know, you're never going to make a change. All of us are like that. Until the pain doesn't get to this certain point, none of us are ever going to change. So my pain did get strong enough, and I knew that I had to change. I have to tell you that when I did go to prison, I met some of the most wonderful women in my life in there. I actually had a great Catholic priest who happened to be in recovery, come in and do my fifth step with him. And then another priest, it was a very pivotal moment in my spiritual growth. It was Easter week, and I kept going in, and I kept saying the same confession over and over again about, you know, how I was responsible for taking the life of somebody who I loved. And the priest, at this one particular juncture, just got so upset and started, like, screaming at me. And he was like, "Jane, who do you think you are to not accept God's forgiveness? I am so sick and tired of you coming in here and doing the same confession month after month after month. Don't do it anymore. Don't come back. I don't want to hear it anymore until you truly let it go and you realize that, you know, God forgives you and your sins are thrown out there into that sea of forgiveness, then don't come back because you're stuck and you need to think about that." So he was really an instrumental part of me, you know, with my psychic change too, because let me tell you something, the hardest thing to do is to self-forgive. The hardest thing by far to do is to forgive yourself. So anyway, prison 5 years, every day an atrocity, but still some really wonderful, wonderful lessons learned in there. I also, when I got out of prison, I got put on probation for 10 years. I lost my license for life with no opportunity ever for a hardship license even. Isn't that kind of weird? But that's the sentence that I got. Florida is pretty tough. As I heard, Texas is really tough too. I had to go, when I got out of prison, part of my probation was to go to an AA meeting every day for 10 years. And can you believe that? I mean, that's true. So anyway, I did go every day for 5 years, and then I went before the judge and I was like, you know, "Your Honor, I am back in school. I'm working full time. You know, can you change this to like maybe 2 or 3 times a week?" And when the gavel came down, she said, "Okay, 5 times a week." You know, and I don't drive. I mean, but she was hardcore. My judge was hardcore. But again, for anybody who's in here who's on probation right now, you know, just do it. Just do it. You can do it. It beats prison. That's what I kept saying, "Man, whatever, I'll do whatever. It beats sitting on a prison bunk." So anyway, I did just that. I went to an AA meeting every day for 5 years. I was working at a hotel making $7 an hour at the front desk, and I thought it was the best job I ever had. I mean, it was really very humbling, but, you know, really, it was a great job. And let me tell you something, as an ex-offender, it is not easy to find employment. So anyway, I went back to school, and when I was in prison, I thought, what can I do with my life? And really, what is life all about? And it's all about love and service.
And what better job to do that than social work? So I went back and I got my master's degree in social work, and I tried to get back into teaching, and I couldn't teach with a felony charge. So anyway, I went back to become a social worker, and I really have had a wonderful journey of rebuilding my life. I've had a lot of angels at every turn willing to give me a second chance. A lot of people believed in me that shouldn't have believed in me. They just took a chance on me. And for those people, I'll be forever grateful. I had the support of my AA friends when I was going through difficult times, or they were rejoicing with me through my triumphant times. I always stayed close to my favorite meetings are literature-based meetings. I love the 12 and 12, and I love big book meetings. And I have a great, I mentioned him before, his name's Diz. I have a great sponsor in Tallahassee who's an old timer. And that's what we do, is just the big book. Big book, big book, big book. And, and my life, like I said, and this part of the story I feel a little uncomfortable with because I have to talk about, myself and good stuff. But I think it's important that the newcomers hear exactly, how things can go if you just keep doing the next right thing. I feel like that's really the basis of what we need to do, is just the next right thing. Keep on doing the next right thing. So I started working at a psychiatric hospital with the mentally ill and with addicts and alcoholics in detox. And then after that, I got asked to teach at Florida State a class of chemical dependency one night a week as an adjunct. And I was like, oh my God, that would be so cool. So, because they told me I would never teach again. So I started teaching my chemical dependency class, which is all about, the brain disease of addiction. I mean, God knows I know everything about that. And I also, had a really good rapport with the dean because I graduated, at the top of my class when I went back to grad school. So anyway, I did that for about 5 years, and then it was one of the times where I was visiting my nephew in his rehab center, and I was having coffee with my brothers at the kitchen table, and we got a call from the dean, and the dean asked me if I wanted to become a full-time faculty member. And I was like, oh my God! Absolutely! So today I am a full-time faculty member at Florida State University, which is a miracle. Oh, my God. I mean, 10 years ago, I was sitting on a prison bunk, So if you put your mind to things and you do the right thing and you just keep taking the next right step, wonderful things can happen. And if you build your credibility with those around you, I mean, great gifts are going to be bestowed upon you. For spring convocation last year, the students voted me Professor of the Year, so I won that award. And then I also, for my service work in the community, the National Association of Social Workers also named me Social Worker of the Year. So, I mean, all this really cool stuff. And again, it's not like to boast, believe me. I just feel like newcomers need to hear that kind of stuff. And, so my life now is really good. It's one of those stories of transformation that we spoke about. I always speak with the language of my heart, and I try to do that even at these conventions. I honestly never know what I'm going to say before I get up here. I have the basic storyline. But I'm certainly hoping that somebody heard something that they needed to hear. My sponsor also tells me that I need to talk about what's happening in my life now. As far as my family, things have never been better. I have the greatest relationship with my mom and my dad, my
my brothers and my sisters, that it's better than it ever was. I just told you about the wonderful job that I have, and I'm teaching all these great classes. Every single class that I teach, I'm passionate about. And in terms of my relationship, I've met the most wonderful man who also puts God first, and I love his prayer for me is, you know, God, today, love Jane through me, and I've started saying the same thing about him, God, love Patrick through me. And really, he's just really into the program, too, and all about, we're on this journey of just spiritually growing together. So it's really wonderful, and Patrick's here, too. Many of you have met him this weekend. But, you know, we're still human, too, and we still struggle with things like resentments, and that's the one that I always struggle with. I think it's just because I'm Irish. But I just thought I'd share with you when I get these resentments, you know, and I still always watch out every day for selfishness, for dishonesty, for resentment, and fear. But my biggest problem, it really is always resentment. So I wanted to share this prayer that Sister B gave me. It's a prayer for the freedom of resentment. And we all know that great expectations lead to great disappointments, and that expectations are indeed premeditated resentments. But serenity comes when we stop expecting and start accepting. And so here's the prayer that I say. God, help me to look with soft eyes upon all who are part of my days. Break through the barriers of my scrutinizing views. Transform my inner landscape into a peaceful place of acceptance. Pull back my projections and criticisms. Replace my mean measurements and my biased expectations with an openness that allows others just to be. Cleanse me of everything that clouds my perceptions and blocks the sunlight of your spirit. And that's the key. Letting go of resentments. Well, today I definitely prefer to glance at the past than to stare at it. I always know that if I ever stumble, the 12 steps are just a few steps away. I know that for all of us here, it's never too late to become the person that you were really meant to be. It's never too late. And I love that. And I also find happiness today in not getting what I want, but, you know, well, in not, how does it go? Not wanting, but in what I get. And I know that, right? Isn't that how it goes? Right. It's not getting what I want, but wanting what I get. Yeah. Okay, I'm humble, right? But also, it's funny because usually when I close, I read that, that's my favorite, The Keys to the Kingdom. So I'll spare you that one from reading it again. But the other, I figured I'd pick another one of my favorites to, before we close, on 420. That's another one of my favorites. Perhaps the best thing of all for me is to remember that my serenity is inversely proportional to my expectations. The higher my expectations of other people are, the lower my serenity. I can watch my serenity level rise when I discard my expectations. But then my rights to move on, they too can force my serenity level down. I have to discard my rights as well as my expectations by asking myself, how important is it really? How important is it compared to my serenity, my emotional sobriety? And when I place more value on my serenity and sobriety than on anything else, I can maintain them at a higher level, at least for the time being. Acceptance is the key to my relationship with God. Today, I never just sit and do nothing while waiting for him to tell me what to do. Rather,
I do whatever is in front of me to be done, and I leave the results up to Him. However it turns out, that's God's will for me. I must keep my magic magnifying mind on my acceptance and off my expectations, for my serenity is directly proportional to my level of acceptance. When I remember this, I can see I've never had it so good. Thank God for AA. Woo! And I really feel that as time goes on, we do, it's like osmosis. We practice the principles in all our affairs. And I feel I do a pretty good job at that right now, having almost 15 years. But I know it's daily work. I definitely take my inventory at the end of the day, and it is daily work. But if we follow these principles, I wanted to just close with this. If we follow these principles, what we'll do is we'll find hope instead of desperation, faith instead of despair, courage instead of fear, peace of mind instead of confusion, self-respect instead of self-contempt, self-confidence instead of helplessness. We're going to gain the respect of others instead of their pity and their contempt. We're going to have a clean conscience instead of guilt. And we're going to establish real friendships instead of loneliness. I've had such a great time at this convention. I want to thank everybody so much. This has been so awesome. And I don't know if I should do this, but I was going to try and maybe, like, sing a song with that. But every time I look at that, let it begin with me. Okay. Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me. With every step I take, the peace was meant to be. To take each moment and live each moment in peace eternally. Let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.